Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 17th, 2006. Today's presentation is entitled Navigating Key Aspects of Any Culture, presented by Jeff Kirsten Geip, number KGJ 2006-01. Let's listen in.
Thanks for your patience. I was fooling around with technology, which is not my strength. And we'll go into things that are my strength. My name is Jeff Kirsten Geip. I teach at the University of Portland, and I'm a communication studies professor, which means I study communication. And this week, I'm going to have a series of sessions that are going to be built around questions associated with communicating across cultural boundaries. That those of you who were at the, was that just this morning that we did the eye-opener thing? Wow. So it feels like 3 days ago. So if you were here 3 days ago this morning, when we did the eye-opener thing, one of the foundational things about dealing with this stuff is that that it's not enough to want to communicate well across cultural boundaries, but that there are some particular things to know about cultures and how they vary, and also particular things to know about how to deal with the things that do vary. It's not magic, but it does require some intention. So this is session one. Please feel free to start burning the CD or whatever sort of magical thing you're doing at the other end of these microphones now. The first thing I'm going to have you do, I'm going to ask you two big questions today, and actually be talking to at least one person who is near you today. So the first thing I'd like to have you do is just turn to somebody near you and introduce yourself by name and hometown, if you would please. Now, no fear if you're a married couple. You don't have to really skip my step. Yeah, you're welcome to work in a threesome. That's just fine. Can I borrow you again? I like this about Holden, that you can say, just learn somebody's name and hometown, and we just go, woo, right down that road. I have a little task for you. The first of two questions today. Today's session really is about what counts as a culture, first of all. What do we mean when we talk about culture? It's one of those words like success that we're not really sure what it means, but we all use it. So we want to first get our head around some answers to that question. And then secondly, I want to talk about the things that are important to notice in any culture so that you at least know what to pay attention to. You don't have to pay attention to everything about a given culture in order to navigate it successfully. The stuff that's happening this week has a lot more to do with piloting the ship than it does to do with landing at particular ports. So you're not going to know a whole lot more about a particular culture as a result of coming to this or any of the sessions this week. But what you will know about is more about what to do when you find yourself, you know, in the navigator's role. So what do I do? How do I steer? What do I pay attention to? What do I avoid? What do I move toward? Regardless of where we're eventually going to dock. So this is sort of a navigational series of sessions. The first thing I'd like you to do is to think just for yourself. You're going to do some cogitating about when you think of culture, how do you define that? What is that just for you individually? Don't talk to that person you just went down the conversational road with yet. But I want you to think to yourself, all right, so when I think of culture, I think of okay? And after you've given that some seconds thought, if you would turn to your partner and smile and see if they smile back, and then talk to each other about your definitions and see if the two of you together can come up with a definition of culture that you're happy with, something that you think captures what culture is. Questions? Okay, give it a try. Give it a try.
What do you think?
American environment and all of that. American and part of that American.
I'm going to start asking for your opinions in about 1 minute. I'd like to make the conversation bigger at this point. I'd like to pull little pieces of the conversation from each of your little conversations here. I recognize that we're going to start more conversations than we'll have time to finish in this hour, and that's partly the point of teaching in Holden, is it gives you stuff then to talk about over dinner. But that I'm hoping that maybe you walk around now and think about, so what is a culture? I want to start here. If you could identify one thing, you trio, that you think comes to mind when you think of a culture, what's involved in a culture?
The activities of a group of people.
So do they have to be shared activities? Or that
all
no,
of the activities?
Just life activities.
Okay, so cultures show up in actual physical things. You see them in actions with that people do with each other.
Right. Well, but we included religion and food and
okay.
All activities.
Great. That works. Somewhere over here?
Values.
Okay, the cultures involve some set of values. What else?
Expectations for how you should act.
Okay. What should I say? Norms? Is that okay?
Behavioral norms.
Okay. Norms, your behavior. What's not up here yet?
Language.
Okay, what about language?
Language is, for me, the top level factor.
Okay. So the language has to be shared?
Yes.
Is that what you mean? Okay. What else? So far we've got cultures involve activities, values, norms, language. I like you people already. This is going to be good.
Rituals, if that's separate from activities.
Okay. It sounded like that was one of the things y'all were talking about. Right? You talked about religion and other stuff. What else isn't up there that should be?
We had climate and history.
Okay, what do you mean by climate?
Well, whether it's a hot climate or a cold climate.
Oh, an actual physical climate.
Physical, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a sense of place.
Okay. Is that an okay way to paraphrase what you're after? Is that it's got a sense of its physical place? A culture reflects the physical place?
Beliefs, would that be separate from values? Beliefs, systems?
Actually, they're usually different things, so they would be different. Values are usually things you think of as either good or bad, and beliefs are things you believe exist or don't exist or are true or false, so they're very different. Is missing.
Location, geographical.
Okay. So that matters to a couple of groups.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I read a book this winter called Chimpanzee Politics.
Called which?
Chimpanzee Politics. It's about primate behavior by a guy named Franz de Waal. And he defines culture as all those elements that are transferred from generation to generation that are taught but not experienced.
So that's the sense of, is that what you meant by history?
Not really history. It's one of the...
How do you differentiate between taught and not experienced? What do they mean by that?
There's this classic thing, there's these guys who studied monkeys in Japan. And they tried to study the monkeys by tracking individual monkeys. Okay? And so the problem is the monkeys live in the forest, and how do you find your monkey in the morning? So they gave them sweet potatoes. And so the monkeys would come down out of the forest every morning at feeding time, just like we do when we ring the bell and we all show up. And then they would give them sweet potatoes. And one monkey, I forget what her name is, figured out that she would wash her sweet potato in the ocean. And of course, it made it cleaner and it tasted better. And pretty soon her children were doing it. And it became part of that monkey's culture. It became part of something they taught that was passed on from one generation of monkeys to another that was never observed in any other monkeys, right? So that they had a way of seeing an act, which was then transmitted, and then Dewall builds on that as to how do chimpanzees develop culture. And he has thousands, lots of examples.
Sure. Well, it feels like one thing we could pull out of that anecdote, too, is that cultures aren't monoliths. They aren't made of things that are inflexible, that cultures do shift and change over time. That so some good new idea comes into a culture, we're capable of then incorporating that into the culture. One of the things we're going to be doing in a few minutes is looking at Holden as a culture, when we talk a little more specifically about culture and see what you think. That's really big, isn't it? Can you see it, Desley? Can you read it? No.
Maybe can you
move it to the back of the fireplace.
Without messing up the Zen.
It's part of the culture.
Yes. Can you see that okay?
No.
So I brought a couple definitions with me, and that's why I was really admiring your definitions, because many of them really feature the same things that I like to feature when I think about culture. I don't know that these are the right definitions, but for me as a communication person, they're very useful definitions, and there's a lot of evidence supporting them as reasonable definitions of what it means to have a culture. This is one by a guy, actually your colleague at Maryland, Don Carbaugh, wrote this one. Culture refers to patterns of symbolic action. So you were talking about language being the top for you. Carbaugh would agree that we don't know culture except through the symbols that convey that culture, and that what gets passed down isn't the culture itself, but this system of symbols and meanings get passed down. So we have these patterns that are felt deeply. They aren't just intellectual things for us. We feel them. And more importantly, we feel violations of them. When somebody violates it, that's not just an intellectual response we have. We have a feeling response to that. Commonly intelligible. So even if you don't participate in all acts of a culture, or maybe you wouldn't use a particular insult with anybody in your life, you know what that insult means, for example. So a set of symbols that maybe you personally would never use, and yet they're part of the culture in which you swim. And widely accessible. That's one definition. Another one that's a little longer and breaks the terms out a little more is Phillipson here talks about cultures as a cultural code of speaking, again featuring that language thing. But it's something we build together and we transmit historically, so there's that sense of it being passed down. And then again, it's a system, just like Carbaugh talked about it as a pattern of symbols and meanings. And those symbols and meanings pertain to how you're supposed to communicate with each other, symbols you're supposed to use, beliefs, rules, norms, we talked about all those things. So virtually everything you talked about is in these couple of definitions here, at least it appears. One of the ways to think about a culture that's more useful because you can do something with it is to think of a culture, any culture, as an iceberg, and that you can see the tip of the culture. Tomorrow we'll talk quite a bit about American, U.S. American culture. And when you think of the tip of the U.S. American iceberg, I bet some of the stuff you'll bring up tomorrow about that are some of the things that people overseas identify as American. So people who are consciously trying to be American in Korea, what pieces of America do they latch onto? That's the part of the culture we see, but there are a couple other layers of the culture that I'd like to talk about. And then maybe these are the things we could apply to Holden, see what you think of Holden. I'm sorry to use overheads too, by the way. When I use these in the classroom with my students, there's something about them that's anesthetizing for students, that you when you turn on an overhead, they take out a piece of paper and they get their pen and they just get ready to write down anything that's on the screen. And as students become stenographers, they stop learning and they just start writing stuff down. So don't be drawn in. But it's a lot better than printing a bunch of paper for y'all. So there are three levels. This is the stuff that's called surface level culture. Really has to do with the tip of the iceberg. Popular culture is generally our phrase for this stuff. So you might identify Mickey Mouse as being really American, for example, or blue jeans, or some other kinds of surface sort of artifacts that have mass appeal and they infiltrate our daily life. I like that particular phrase. And then we've got this intermediate level culture that gets at some of the stuff you had me write on the whiteboard a few minutes ago. This is just under the water of the iceberg. Cultures are made up of particular symbols, signs, artifacts, gestures, a certain kind of nonverbal behavior that reflects something meaningful. And that not just language is a symbol system, but also the nonverbal communication we do is a symbol system that we learn just as well. It's not a random thing, it's a pattern. Can you think of any symbols that you would associate with Holden Village? Things that are really characteristic of this place? And for this question, people who are newly here might be able to see some of this stuff even better than people who've been here for a while. Are there things you would identify as uniquely Holden-ish symbols?
Spatulas on the table.
Yeah, excellent. Great artifact. What else?
A bell.
Pardon?
The bell.
Yeah, being summoned by a bell. I don't do that at home.
Words like potty control or weight child.
Jaws, Hobart. Kinds of things. Post-I, haven't heard of post-I or we-try anywhere else. And yet those terms have outlived the people who coined them. It's an extended, historically transmitted system of symbols and meanings. Then we have meanings or interpretations that we attach to symbols, and they can cue both, dictionary meanings, but also subjective reactions that we have. And then we've got these cultural norms, particular things, expectations of what constitutes proper or improper behavior in a given scene. So, for example, in worship last night, when we shared the piece, luckily I remembered this from our earlier time at Holden, that sharing the piece at Holden is a different event than sharing the piece at home, where you basically just kind of pivot in the pew and you say hello to the people who are around you and that's it. And in Holden, people are leaping pews and gathering in bunches and it goes on and on and on. That's one particular kind of norm, that's what's done here, and that you'd mark yourself as an outsider or a newcomer by not doing that or by thinking it was bad or somehow otherwise inappropriate. So when you're looking at, oh, I could hide all that stuff. Can you think of particular cultural norms here that shout Holden to you? Ways of doing things that seem characteristic of this place and this community, this culture? Name some.
Consensus.
On?
On anything. That's how decisions are made.
Okay. So consensus-based decision making is one of the norms of the place. If somebody were to make a decision that didn't try for consensus, what would happen to that person?
You just keep trying until you got consensus.
Okay, and if somebody refused to keep trying?
They would leave the community of their own accord, not because the community asked them to.
Okay, so it becomes a difficulty anyway for trying to violate that norm and stay within the culture. That's a difficult thing to manage. That's how you recognize the norm often is by its violation. What other, a couple more norms you could identify as things that are unique to this place?
Separating our garbage.
Yeah. Sam's very excited about this. I've got an 8.5-year-old who's asking if he can do Garbo. He's in there with me this morning doing dish team, standing on a crate, washing pots, and he had a great time with that. And that's not something he's excited to do at home. So there's something about cultures that is infectious.
Worship.
You know, I think that we watch the kids, and they're all running all over the place, mm-hmm. and it's okay. You know, maybe if you're in the park, even sitting at home, you'd be really much more closely watching them mm-hmm. than here. And if a kid falls and scrapes a knee, everybody picks him up.
Right. So kind of a culture of vigilance and care for the younger ones. Here. That's how we feel as parents. We can say, go play in the street. We'll see you at dinner time. But that's a fine thing to say here. We wouldn't say that at home.
Nothing is ever locked.
Okay.
Worship.
Okay, what about it? That's unique to here.
There's an expectation.
So
it's a rule.
something that we all do, that we're all expected to do. So this is the second layer. The top layer is the stuff you see, the pop culture. This layer we talk about kind of patterns of regularity, symbols we have with each other, and things that we do with each other that are considered normative. And then we've got these. We've got some culturally shared traditions, culturally shared beliefs, and cultural values. These are at the deep level culture. This stuff doesn't change much. I mean, the base of an iceberg is down where it's coldest, right? And I guess I don't know that, but I guess I'm assuming. In a culture, these are the things that change the least. These are the things we're most wedded to. We'll change our artifacts just like that. We go from those low-rise muffin-top jeans to the next style of jean, you know, no big deal. But the values thing, that's a much harder shift to make in any culture. So the culturally shared traditions include things like, you mentioned activities. I think up here are several kinds of those activities. Legends, ceremonies, rituals, myths. You know what a myth is culturally? Is you tell a story about, say, winning a game or coming from behind in a race, and then every time you tell the story, you came from a little bit further behind, right? Than you truly did. But you know, in the telling, it gets, your chances were even less, and nobody was giving you a chance, and all that stuff. Why would you do that? It's because it's one of the great cultural myths of the U.S. Right? It's the underdog myth. So the more you can fit your story to the underdog myth, the further into the culture you are, and the more you reinforce your place in it by making your stories fit the cultural myths. Things like the underdog myth or the David Goliath kind of thing. It's fun to read the sports pages and hear these myths articulated over and over by players being interviewed about their performance. So we have culturally shared traditions, culturally shared beliefs, fundamental assumptions or worldviews that everybody in the culture supposedly shares, and then cultural values that guide good or bad behavior, desirable, undesirable practices. I'd like you to do one other thing with your partner here, if you would. I'd like you to see if you could generate, I thought I got somebody's foot, and there's nobody there. Would you identify with your partner, see if you can come up with something that fits one of these three categories that you think is characteristic of Holden, something you would identify. It's not exclusive to Holden. It could be a value or a belief or a tradition that others have as well, but see if you can identify something that you would identify, that you would say is Holden-esque at this level, the steepest level of the iceberg. Ready, go.
What do you think?
Yeah.
That's
pretty good. You've heard about that already, right? Every day.
Time. May I ask? Can we start at the bottom? If you would just go ahead and just shout out into the room some of the things you identify as cultural values. You notice, by the way, here that I'm presuming Holden is or has its own unique culture. Does it seem like that's an accurate assumption so far as you look at these kinds of things? Holden feels kind of unique to me. Like, Portland is allegedly has a biking culture, like a bicycling culture. I'm not sure if that's really a culture, but Holden, I feel pretty firm in thinking that this is a culture. So what sort of cultural values did you identify as Holden-esque?
First thing we came up with, eating low on the food chain.
Okay, eating low on the food chain.
Genuine interest and trust.
Okay, in other people? Okay.
That's being inclusive of all people.
Okay.
Sustainability.
Okay, working at sustaining. Did you just say economist on your brain?
Yeah.
Okay.
Economist.
How about these, culturally shared beliefs?
Eating low on the food chain did not used to be a value.
Look at that. Cultures are flexible.
What?
Yeah,
cultures
are flexible. In the
70s
it began, basically.
Yeah, well, I cooked with Paul Hinderle, and eating low on the food chain was not.
Yeah, right.
How about this? Culturally shared beliefs, fundamental assumptions, or worldviews that we hold dearly to our hearts without question if we're part of Holden culture. Name something.
Being in nature is good.
Okay, being in nature is good. It's not bad, it's good.
Peace, not war.
Okay, we work toward nonviolence, peace.
Non-materialism.
Okay, non-materialism.
Unity.
Okay.
Peaceably in community with others.
Okay. There is a supreme being. That seems to be one aspect of this culture that's not.
Right.
It seems pretty widely shared. How about these culturally shared traditions? Myths, legends, ceremonies, rituals? What would you identify as things that are characteristic of Holden?
Okay, West Breed,
yeah.
West is a great, yeah.
It's a foundation myth.
Stories.
I mean, legend. True story.
Okay.
Ice cream.
And that's Jonathan. They really blew up the windows.
They did.
But that's a little known myth.
That's others?
Vespers, maybe, sir.
Okay, yeah. Talking Vespers.
Hunger awareness.
Okay, having that awareness meal. I would say naming everything is characteristic. I mean, that you're picked up in a bus named Pookie.
The whole bus coming and going.
The bell rings and people gather to say hello, say goodbye. That's not a random thing. That's a ritual. We do that each day. There are a lot of rituals in Holden. Even the way things are done day to day is very ritualistic. If you look at how the Waitry work. The Waitry system has to outlast any of the Waitry who are going to be here in person, because they're going to be new Waitry in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever. So everything's on laminated cards, as you pointed out the other day. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole system, you know, meant to carry on these traditions that. So when we're thinking about a culture, I like the metaphor of the iceberg. That works for me. So I hope it works for you as well, to think about some parts of the culture being just eminently visible, and others you are kind of refracted by the water a little bit. But if you look hard enough, you can see patterns of behavior and symbol use that we do with each other, and you can read into those the values and things that really underlie really any culture, whether it be U.S. American mainstream culture, Holden culture, Korean culture, it could be anything. So that's really the focus of the sessions this week, are thinking about, all right, if I'm residing in this culture or in these cultures, because we all belong to multiple cultures, cultural groups, how do I navigate those boundaries? One other assumption I'm making this week is that we all have memories of times when that didn't go very well, that we can all recount at least one incident to ourselves and perhaps to the person sitting next to us, of a situation where I really felt like a fish out of water. I was trying to communicate with somebody who clearly was not like me, and it wasn't going very well. Either they weren't getting me, or I wasn't getting them, or we just weren't getting each other. So your last task of the day is to try and conjure up one of those situations, something you've either witnessed or experienced, where it seems to have been a cultural difficulty, not just an interpersonal dislike, but something happened that just felt like you didn't get it, or the other person didn't get it. See if you can get one of those in your head. And if you can, would you please, if you don't mind, share as much or as little of it as you're willing with this same safe partner you've been talking to? talking with this whole time. And we'll use that to unpack some other categories to look at in a culture, things that will help you navigate. I realize this is a little bit of an imposition because I'm asking you to recount something where you may not have felt very successful, something that Americans don't like to do very much, especially male Americans. We don't like to describe things that didn't go well. But I'm going to ask it anyway.
Which I think is one of the things, I mean, one is really surprising. Some say it's great. Yeah, even if it's and I've had a really good value of it.
Your stories aloud here, but what I'm going to do is show you several categories of particular kinds of communication what I'd love to have you do is to identify when you get to a category that goes, I think that was the one that was most responsible for whatever misunderstanding I experienced. I bet it was because of that. That's when I'd love to hear an example shared with the group. So instead of just sharing the example now, I'll share with you some categories and then see if you can come up with illustrations of them, what you just talked about. Because I bet you're gonna see things and go, that was it. That was it. I'm focusing on nonverbal communication because if you think about it, that's the stuff that's most mysterious. You can learn a language, but think of all the things we say and do with each other in just a conversation among people who supposedly share the same culture. How do you know when it's your turn to talk, for example? How do you know when it's your turn to communicate? Okay? So you're looking for this gesture. What if you aren't in a conversation where the two parties are going like this at each other? Or going, over! So that kind of stuff. What do you look for? What do you listen for? How do you know when it's your turn to talk? Okay, a little lull, so there's a little space.
Your voice inflection just went down.
Just went down. So we read that as an invitation. We can also invite someone like this. Yes, so you're nodding in response to that. So that works. So we listen to intonation, we listen for spaces. What else?
Nodding.
Yeah, eye contact.
Eye contact. What sort of eye contact tells the person it's their turn?
Sometimes it's a looking away kind of eye contact rather than a looking at.
Excellent. Americans usually look away, and then look again when they're ready to surrender their turn. So when they look back at you, you know it's about your turn. Often there's an intake of breath that tells the other person that a person is ready to break in. You'll just hear somebody getting ready to expel some words, and then you rapidly figure out, okay, how do I wind up so this person can get in? I have a friend named Milt who will do that, or he'll just start going. When he wants to get it, start opening his mouth, and he'll start making the first sound. Just to get in. If that doesn't work, he'll just hold the first sound. It's like a popcorn motor revving up, getting in. But the point is, that's the hard stuff, is nonverbal communication. The verbal stuff, you can learn a language, but you still go into a new culture. I speak Spanish! And you go to Costa Rica and you are lost. And it's because of all of the other intangible things here. There are nonverbal display rules, when, where, with whom, and how different emotions are supposed to be expressed or suppressed. That's all learned within a culture. To communicate appropriately with the members of an unfamiliar society, you can't just know how to formulate messages intelligibly. You also have to know how to dance, you know, in conversation with the other person. What kinds of codes, channels, and expressions to use, what kinds of situations, to what kinds of people. That's really what this week is about, is figuring out those kinds of things. Not that you're going to learn that about a particular culture, but that you'll learn, okay, so what sorts of codes are there? What kinds of channels are available? What sorts of expressions often get used? What sorts of situations are especially chancy? And how do I manage them? What sorts of concerns should I have with certain kinds of people? And the key to all this is this last thing here. We learn it. Nonverbal communication, as I mentioned before, it's symbolic and pattern and communicates meaning, just like a language does. But we don't have nonverbal communication class. We have English class, you know, as we're growing up. We learn it, but we learn it more implicitly. And it's hard, it's more vague to figure that stuff out. Getting the work out here. So one of the ways that cultures can vary is in repertoire. There are really three things to pay attention to. We pay attention to particular cultures have norms about what sorts of emotions you're expected to be expressing. What sorts of stuff are you supposed to be competent at showing other people? I had some Finnish relatives in central Minnesota who were very restrained. There wasn't very much emotion. You couldn't tell when Toivo was mad or really happy. There wasn't a whole lot of difference there. And yet, you know, for him, he was encoding those things appropriately. And that gets to these cultural display rules. How are you supposed to do these kinds of things? How are you supposed to display certain emotions? If you're expected to have them in your repertoire, how do you do them? I think again about how people do grief. How are you expected to do grief? How are you expected to be, say, in the audience at the funeral of a friend? What's appropriate?
Ellen and I went to China 3 years ago, and the trip was arranged by a friend of ours in Maryland, and she said, you'll be taken care of, don't worry about it. And so we flew to Beijing and got off the plane, and there's somebody with a sign that says Wallace, and we go with them. Mm-hmm. And so we said, well, what's going to happen next? Where are we going to go? They really didn't want to tell us. Mm-hmm. And then eventually we figured out that the fact that we were asking them was offensive, because in fact we were intimating that there wasn't a plan that we weren't going to be taken care of. Finally, just shut up.
That's great. Just my little plan. Thursday's session is all about exactly that dilemma. going from a low context culture such as ours to a high context culture such as China, and how those things are read and what sorts of things to pay attention to in those sessions, etc. So when you think about doing grief, I know how to do grief. I'm comfortable to the degree one can be comfortable at a funeral. I know how I'm supposed to be. I watch news coverage of, say, a funeral procession in the Middle East. Same situation. Somebody has died, but people really mad, really upset, really upset. Or if you've ever heard Irish keening, for example, just this, that sort of, ever heard keening? Just an emotional, it's really hard to listen to. That can be enormous as well. So we have these variants in cultural display rules, and then we vary also in how we can interpret things. What does this mean? Anything else? Oh, I suppose it could be power, but it means relaxation. So in our culture, it's got sort of just a random thing. Oh, I guess he got uncomfortable and decided to stretch his legs. We might interpret some behaviors as just idiosyncratically. When Sam, my son, gets tired, he starts to pull on his hair and starts to go like this. So when he does that, I know he's tired. But that's not something everybody does. That's not, you can't walk around at the end of the day and see your, you know, everybody on the street. But we do also have behaviors where the meaning is interpreted as shared. And where we often have trouble is a behavior we interpret as random, other people interpret as meaningful. For example, showing the sole of your shoe in many cultures is the ultimate insult. If you remember news coverage of the latest Iraq invasion, there were photos of people slapping statues of Saddam with their shoes. You know, this is a huge insult to do this in many cultures. Whereas us, we just interpret it as, you know, random behavior. Unless, John, are you really mad at me?
No,
so we had
it earlier, right?
All right, so we have these different ways that, things that we look at, different codes to pay attention to. That's the last thing I wanted to get to today. One thing we look at a lot, actually, in our culture are just artifacts, the things we pick. We don't dress randomly. We don't drive random things. We don't go random places and, you know, buy random artifacts. But we pick those things on purpose. We mean them to send a message. Did any of you have a story that is related to misinterpreting some kind of artifactual thing that was going on?
I was in Thailand a year ago visiting our son who was teaching there. And there was a national holiday. They have all kinds of them, so I can't remember. Well, my son described it as Christmas and Easter rolled into one.
Oh, I think I know the one.
And there was a running group at kind of a workout area that was sponsoring a run. We participated in the run and then walked up to the Buddhist temple, and we processed around the temple several times and were given candles, which was a great experience. But as we got up there, we were given little plastic cases with Buddha in them, and there was a Thai man that was very courteous and kind to us, but I just looked at the Buddha and put it in my pocket, and he told me that that was very disrespectful.
What were you supposed to do?
Hold it.
Okay, now put it in your pocket. Great. One of the things that is most offensive about Americans overseas is our practice of handkerchiefs. That you would take something out of your pocket, blow your nose in it, and put it back in your pocket. That for many cultures, that's the equivalent of, you know, going to the bathroom, wiping yourself, putting it in your pocket, you know, and carrying that around. But it's just incomprehensible. For us, it's just normal. And in fact, you would use a handkerchief that somebody else had already used. Or maybe I'm just talking about my family. Here's a couple systems we don't use a whole lot in the US. These two here, we don't rely on very much. But they are systems, they are nonverbal codes that other cultures pay a lot of attention to. Again, this will be important on, especially in Thursday's session, if you choose to come to that one about high and low context. But there is a chemical code system that we make some interpretations from things that we can't control very much, like body odor or tears or sweat or, you know, gas, household smells, that all those kinds of things are meant to be meaningful and you're supposed to read into those things in some cultures. Whereas ours, that's not part of what you're expected to know. In some cultures, for example, you're expected to, if you feel like you want to pass gas or belch at a meal, that it's impolite to hold that in. You really should be not masking yourself with perfumes and good smells. You should really be mingling with the people there in that sense as well. You may not even be aware that you're offending by trying to you know, cover up the smells of your body. The dermal code system, we also pay attention sometimes to, you know, whether somebody's blushing or turning white or, you know, having goosebumps. That in many cultures, this is a very important code to pay attention to, not so much in ours. Here's one we pay a lot of attention to. We mentioned this earlier, looking at the non-word sounds and characteristics of speech. That stuff. Paralinguistic. Paralanguage means it goes along with the language, parallels the language. But that we read a lot into how people talk. I could talk to you like this, for example. I could choose a different paralinguistic code. I could choose a much more patronizing way of talking. Couldn't I? And if I printed out what I was saying, it would look just like what I was saying before. And it would get a totally different response if you use different paralinguistic cues. So we read a lot into that kind of stuff. I don't choose that particular teaching voice. And in fact, I don't get to use this teaching voice very much at home. I have a different paralinguistic style I use at home where Emily just kind of looks at me cross. So we have all these various things that we can look at, where the accent goes, how we're pronouncing words together, how I pitch my voice, how intense, how high or low my voice carries, how loud, how I articulate, how quickly I speak. All of these things convey meaning. Do any of you have an example that you came up with of your misunderstanding that you would attribute to something paralinguistic? Is there anything about paralanguage that would explain that misunderstanding? Some languages, I'll share one of them, some languages are tonal, meaning that the word means different things if you do different, if your pitch range changes. I met a woman from Vietnam when I was in graduate school whose name was Kim Nguyen. And I said, oh, so your name, it was Nguyen, so you're Kim Nguyen. She said, no, Kim Nguyen. Okay. I said, Kim Nguyen. No, Kim Nguyen. And then apparently I was calling her a cow. If I said it the other way, it really has a whole different meaning, that there is sometimes a tonal difference.
I just thought of when Mike and I sometimes joke that we can actually have whole arguments by only saying each other's name. Like, Michael? Susan? Michael? You know, then we know exactly that Michael meant, you don't know what you're saying, and the Susan that he just said that, please,
right.
You don't have to go there. I know what you're talking about. a whole argument.
And you understand each other very well while you do that, right?
That are inflected, yeah.
You aren't saying any more than you have to. There are very few, this is one that sort of messes us up sometimes, is we think of kinesics. If you're familiar with kinetic energy, it's the study of motion. Kinesics is the study of body motion, basically. When people talk about body language, often they're talking about kinesics. The argument is that there's some genetic basis for a lot of the stuff we do with our face. If you can remember sad fish, these are the things that Paul Ekman claims you can recognize across most cultures. That we recognize sadness when we see it, you know, in China, for example. Somebody looks sad, they look a lot like I look when I'm sad. Anger, disgust, fear, interest, surprise, happiness. But most of what we know about this stuff is not universal. In fact, it's you have to be careful about interpreting, for example, a smile. A smile could just mean the person has gas. It could mean they're about to hit you. Or it could mean that they're really happy to see you. You know, a smile can mean so many different things. It can really vary across these, across cultures. So one of the things we look at kinesically are gestures, things that we do with gestures. Sometimes we have gestures that substitute for words. Some are meant to use, they go along with words. I'm using one right now, I notice, as I'm talking and pointing. You know, that we do things that coordinate with our language. We have nonverbal behavior, some of the ones we talked about, that regulate our verbal behavior. How do you know when it's your turn to talk, for example? We do things nonverbally with our eyes and our voice, whatever. And we have adapters, things that we do to make ourselves happy. You know, I flip hands, I pick the skin around my, you probably don't want to know that. But we all have these things that we do that also convey meaning. You can tell if somebody's anxious if they're, you know, kind of having a lot of adaptive communication. Was there anything gestural that any of you identified as sort of the crux point of the misunderstanding that you talked about with your partner?
We didn't talk about this, but one experience that I had when we were in India is that
India,
they shake their head back and forth, but it doesn't sometimes they'll say, oh yes, while they do it, but sometimes they just shake their head, which when somebody goes like this, we think that means no. And a lot of times they just shake their head, they don't say yes at the same time. So there's a lot of times where you think the person is saying no, and you might just keep asking them things, and they're always answering yes, and you don't realize it because they don't speak.
That's a great example.
And it's especially true if you're being served and you go like this, it means you want more. And you put your hand out if you don't want any more. So if I say this, then I'm getting more.
Yep. And so many of the symbols we use, you know, we go like this to summon people. That's how you summon a dog in many cultures. Many cultures you summon a person like this. Instead of like this, it's a huge difference. Doing this is very different than doing this. Cultures is the equivalent of this. That's not really what you want to do. You know, this is offensive in many cultures, this particular one. So, I mean, there are lots of things that we consider to be the famous story of Richard Nixon getting off a plane, doing his classic, you know, this thing, and then he'd do with his hands, and went, ooh, and not realizing the culture in which he landed, that was the equivalent of flipping the audience the bird. It's a big audience. It turned out to see the first American president ever to visit this country. And he gets standing on the top step of Air Force One, and the first thing he does is, you know, basically. We also look at touch when we're looking at things that vary across cultures. That it can be, you may intend it as a greeting ritual, somebody else may read it as you just being playful or working to try and control someone. You probably all experienced somebody's arm around your shoulder in a way that, you know, was probably looked like affection, but was really more about control, and that, you know, we learn how to read those differences. So we look at touch. I'm not gonna ask about this one. Just to know that cultures also, we really differ in terms of how much contact we prefer, and that's often a big source of discomfort for people moving between cultures. Especially if you're from a low contact culture and you visit a high contact culture where people are always touching you and kissing you and hugging you, holding, and some people really have a response to that that's difficult. So, how comfortable are you looking another person in the eye, touching, kissing, speaking in loud voices? We're more of a moderate contact culture here in this the mainstream part of U.S. culture anyway.
You know, I have a question.
Go ahead.
My experience in South Asia was not that it was a low contact culture.
Where were you?
India, Nepal. Thailand, yeah, I would say it was a low contact culture, but not in India.
Right.
Well, because there are so many people are sitting on your lap on a bus.
Right.
You know.
Well, and you see things like, men walking together hand.
Right. That's a big norm. In Turkey, that's
I don't know.
Yeah, the generalizations don't hold for every case, or even, you know, as cultures shift and change. A lot of cultures, you're just, more and more people are living there, and people just get more used to being in close proximity to each other. It becomes more of a high-contact culture just by what it is. Well, so we end up studying. Sorry, I want to get through these last bits, but I want to have more conversation with you over there. Proxemics is one of the other things we look at, is this use of space. Would you stand up for a second, Pauline, just for a minute? How comfortable are you, where would you want to be if we were having a conversation?
That's good.
That's good. Okay, so, Ian, thank you. That's all I needed before. many other countries feel, participants in those cultures feel much less comfortable at that distance, and they'll keep trying to reduce that distance, and we, you know, waltzing with them, backing away, and we get a reputation as relatively cold people for that reason. So we have to manage those boundaries. And chronemics is another kind of boundary management we have to do. I'm curious if any of your stories have to do with this notion of use of space. Did any of the misunderstandings revolve around space? We have 2 minutes remaining, so I'm after a good space story. Desley?
I just have a little incident, which is, I didn't realize traveling in South Korea, that they're not a queuing culture, is what they say. So there's no lining up. So there's a mob suddenly when the door opens to go in, whatever it is. A mob, and there's this contact, eye contact, all sides, suddenly. Quite a difference for us.
Okay. And it doesn't mean anything, or it doesn't mean what it would mean here.
It doesn't mean anything, and it also doesn't, it does mean something. In other words, the older people who are not in the fresh and are coming on behind, you know, we don't look back. We just try and get in the door. kind of culture.
So when we're looking at some of these categories, especially the ones that aren't prominent in our own culture, it helps to know what those categories are, so when you move to a culture where those things do matter, you start to look for them. Again, a lot of the sessions this week are going to treat maybe one or two questions a piece. Today was just what counts as a culture, and then what do you look for in a particular culture? I wanted to pick nonverbal stuff today because it's sort of fun to watch for. Watch for here and see what things you would identify as sort of culturally specific to Holden, nonverbal enactments where we're reinforcing our place in the culture. The people who've been here for a while, how do they signal that to each other that they really are here and belong here? So thanks for coming today. There'll be more this week. Thank you.